What's going on with dance and stuff? What's happening with dance and things? What's going on? What's happening? What's going on with dance and stuff?
Oh, hello. The song just played, I'm assuming. Hello, Jack. Good afternoon.
Hello, Reed. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm trying to stay organized. I'm trying to take on some responsibilities every day for both myself and for civic responsibility, a lot of which I'm finding out about through Instagram. I'm signing petitions and I'm donating money and, you know, generally trying to put aside a little bit of time each day to learn something that I didn't know and take on some responsibility for the atrocities of our race.
Yeah, I think that's that. That is my hope of what everyone, or I rather I should say that what white people are doing and who may be listening to this podcast right now. And also in terms of that, there are many resources that can be found on the internet. And I know that I said this, I think when we were talking with Bill, I'm also up for giving resources, from the privilege I've had. Oh no, I said this with Jess. It's like the privilege of in working in academic situations where we were able to be given anti-racist trainings and literature to read, and there's more literature to read always, and yes, all of that. And as you also said, doing something for yourself as well, because this is the a long haul.
Yeah, I don't think at this point we can put aside how difficult this time is just generally for us as individuals.
No.
You know, putting aside the fact that we're now in this enormously tumultuous moment because of race, because of the death of George. And I think it's still important to remember that, you know, we've all been on our own, cooped up in houses for
you might feel kooky from being cooped.
Yeah, you are kooky, yeah, cooped up. And so, you know, we still have to take care of ourselves. If you need to do some yoga class, Cunningham class each day to feel like your head's on straight, absolutely take that time for yourself.
Well, and I will also say that, you know, there's that adage of give away the flame and not the oil. And I really know what it is to give away the oil. And to just not eat, not sleep, and get loud about it. That is, and we're seeing, you know, I think we're seeing that, obviously we're seeing that with our healthcare workers with COVID in terms of burnout. And this is a real, okay, but, and I love that you brought up being organized. You're very good at that. And I think that is what this requires, is a long, organized dismantling of the power structures of the world.
Yeah. And I think it doesn't have to be that hard. I know it seems overwhelming, but there are many things that you can look at on Instagram, especially the ones where it lays out in like 5 pages. Like, here are the simple steps to take to assert yourself as someone who's trying to help make a difference. And that means grassroots efforts inside of the law to try to make a difference, to change legislation, to change the people in power. And, you know, in a country that is still a democracy, hopefully for the time being, we still have the power to do that.
Sorry, you broke up there on my end. I couldn't hear you.
Well, I recorded it. You'll just have to listen. You'll just have to hear it on the pod.
Yeah, something that what was great that is free and that I've been reading is The End of Policing through Verso Books. And also just understanding that this place of the police as a place to take care of everything the government is not doing. In fact, the things the government is doing to ensure race inequalities, class inequalities, and then just having the police go and clean it up. And so, and the way the police are used by this completely ineffectual government, and the power they're granted, and the, as people have probably seen, if especially if you are, if you follow Rita Nye, there have been many things coming up right now about how much, and this was news to me, about how funded the police are compared to other programs.
Mm.
That has been really, really helpful. Again, and you can find it through Verso Books. It's written by Alex, I believe his last name is pronounced Vitale, and who is one of our New York professors. And it's great. And obviously, I just have to continue. The tear gassing of people to get out of the way for Trump to pose with a Bible in front of a church.
Wow.
Reed said this last week, and I'm going to reiterate. If you are a Republican, how dare you?
I mean, revise that slightly, Jack.
Don't listen to us anymore.
No. Revise the part about being a Republican.
To what?
I think that if you have Republican values, it's okay. If you support Donald Trump, that is very far outside the values of being a Republican. So if you want to be true to your values, then you're lying to yourself if you support him and vote for him.
Yeah, I am unfamiliar really with what the values of the Republican Party are in this, in a real way, as I would feel similarly. But, you know, I also have a problem with this two-party system. And
well,
that
it feels very clear that a lot of Republicans in this nation are not connected to whatever their values may be, because they're acting like totally valueless human beings, like worthless pieces of shit, that they don't stand up to him, that they don't speak out against him because they're so afraid of losing their hold on power in the government. And that is what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's ridiculous. Every single politician should be outraged. They should all be speaking out against him.
And that is the thing that's in this, in terms of in this book about In the End of Policing, where he talks about how much the government doesn't do to take care of this supposed society. And that is both on the right and the left. And I think it is in what for a lot of people felt hard in Bernie not going forward.
Yeah.
But there is no choice. Donald Trump cannot be president. We are heading, as we all have talked about forever, into an autocracy, and the racism is extremely set on fire and allowed for by calling, you know, we talked about this in the last episode. You know, people storming a Michigan Capitol and they're like good people. And then other people being called thugs.
I'm shocked on the daily that this country is allowing him to continue to be president every day. I'm like,
I am shocked. I don't get it.
When is enough enough? I mean, I had like an out loud LOL when I saw that photograph of him holding the Bible, but when they changed the words in the placard next to him that were, you know, I think, I don't know what they said it originally, but they did a transcription of his, of the words he said in that trailer where he talked about grabbing pussies.
Oh, and they put it on that?
Yeah, it was really funny. Good.
I mean, also that there was someone who works for that church who got tear gassed.
Well, excuse me, the management of that church immediately put out a press release that was like, we do not stand with this person. He does not align with our values. So bravo to them. Bravo to any Christians who see right through him, as if Donald Trump had any kind of religious values. I mean, I don't have religious values, but the fact that he pretends to is outrageous.
Is outrageous, and his incitement of his evil constituents is, you know, and it's what we've been seeing this unfold, and here we are, and with a pandemic and tinderbox of racial inequality that was broadcast on national television that took forever for those officers to be arrested, all four. I can't believe it. it's, mm-hmm. and then you can believe it, right? Because mm-hmm. you look back and, I mean, you and I grew up with Rodney King mm-hmm. and thinking about Ferguson. It's just, anyhow, I don't want us to talk too long because I want us to bring our guest on and get to our guest who has lived through a lot and has a lot to say, and honored to have Bill T. Jones on today. Oh, Bill, I can't thank you enough for joining us. And first of all, where are you located right now?
I am here in Valley Cottage, and I would like to do a land acknowledgement. Have you been doing those?
We, yes. I don't think we've been doing them on our pod.
We've not.
In terms of starting time where we're at. Yes, so please.
Well, yes, because I am in... let me see if I can, well, I can't pick it up right now, but I'd like to acknowledge the land of the Ramapo peoples who were here long before I was, and any other indigenous people that might be listening to this broadcast now. And there's also one for New York Live Arts.
Oh, what is the you one for that, New York Live Arts?
Well, there's a whole group of Native peoples, and whose name now escaped me, and I should open my computer, my phone, and read it, but I won't. But I'm sure you could find that. I would really encourage you to do that.
I will. I think.
This is
I
a
will.
Time.
I first encountered land acknowledgement doing a job in Canada a few years ago, and the National Ballet of Canada at their big theater did that before the show, and I thought, well, we should all be doing mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that I haven't heard
the same
more.
Thing happened when I go ahead. Sorry, Bill.
Well, you know Emily Johnson.
Yes, and we just did a panel together, and we talked about that when we were on an advisory committee.
And did she insist that we before it started yes. that they did they do?
Yeah,
one?
Yeah.
She has good habit. It's hard for me to do. It's like me getting my pronouns together with all of my performers. You know, I have a trans person, and I fuck up at least one rehearsal, if not twice, using the wrong pronoun for them. I don't know if you guys, if you think that, you know, as gay men, and we can say that, I'm assuming I'm speaking to two cisgendered men who identify as he.
I also go by all. I also go by all, which came up. It's interesting. We just had a faculty conversation, and I told my faculty that it's something that I start every semester going through and asking my students what their pronouns are, and that my pronouns are all. But I realized at the faculty level, with these people I've been teaching with since 2013, I don't do that. I don't.
I know what you mean.
It's an interesting dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did a COVID panel with Carrie Mae Weems and Dr. Aletha Frank, I believe her name is, who is now the first Black woman at the American Medical Association in her position, talking about COVID. And in that situation, it didn't occur to me to do it. And when it was over, we had been talking about some very intense things. So I thought, well, why didn't that? So it's something about... as gay people or men of our description, maybe we're doing, what is it, the double consciousness? Mm. And we sometimes fuck up.
Right.
Oops, I'm sorry, am I allowed
you to can swear? Absolutely sometimes. Swear. You can absolutely swear through this whole podcast. I swear all the time.
Sometimes we have to have like triple consciousness, right?
Yeah.
You know, how can you be a, because right now in the middle of this, as my sisters are reminding me, there's two pandemics now.
Yeah.
So who in each pandemic, I have another relationship. And if you want to consider the Considering New Futures document that's being generated by people in our field about the inequities of capitalism in terms of artist salaries and the artists being shut out during this time where they were just canceled with no concern about what happens to their lives. If someone loses a whole fall, you know, in that situation, I am at once an artist, but I'm also an administrator.
Right.
So I have to wear a lot of hats. I'm sure you both do as well, don't you? Do you know the document I'm referring to?
Yeah, that which just began. I mean, that just well, and I just went to Jay Bowie and Melanie Green's
the town hall
town
the other night.
Hall.
The town.
Yeah.
Which I heard about yesterday from Kyle Maud in my office.
Yeah, Kyle was there.
It was kind of amazing. It was amazing to see so many
familiar faces from the dance community showing up. Mm-hmm. And it was very moving and provocative, and it's available for everybody to still watch. So we recommend that.
I heard that they were primarily young people.
It was.
Because Kyle's impression was that they did not invite the seniors.
Well, Jay Bowie brought up that I don't want to say what Jay said. Jay brought up a discussion around elders, and that it was considered, and that there's more to be discussed on that. Mm-hmm. Was how it was left, and also it seems. I mean, they were very transparent with the expediency with which they needed to put the town hall together with.
And what do you mean by that? They did it in a short period of time?
Or, I mean, how quickly they needed to, mm-hmm. they wanted to get it together. And I also believe that it is going to be, and I hope it will be the first of many to continue a really necessary dialogue inside of this community, inside of the dance community, which is already... So,
yeah,
what's the words to use? I mean, yes. In terms of where we even fall in the capital juggernaut ladder, of extreme difficulties in funding, though something I love that was brought up in the town hall was an idea that in the nonprofit sector, there is enough for everyone, and it is a matter of us coming. We need to be coming more together, less competitive. Mm. And I think that really
does that sound right to you, Jack? Is that right? Well, I've seen your work, my friend, and your work is the blood that's on the floor, psychological and physical, in in studios, and particularly in the ballet world and all. And yeah. It seems almost a sacrament. I don't know, maybe I've drank the Kool-Aid about. I thought that there was something at play in the way art gets made and the way the best ideas get to the front. Well, isn't it true that's one of the things that you deal with, at least in the works I've seen, is that why is there so much Sturm und Drang in those situations in the rehearsal room and who the director is and the relationship between the performers? And
in terms of my own work, it was always, I mean, my commissions were like $3,000, $5,000. Mm. I think the biggest commissions I've ever had were from New York Live Arts. And really? from Bard College when they put together Chambre. But up until that point, the largest commission I had was 11 when I did Rumble Ghost, 11 grand. And I didn't have private funders, and I wasn't... The first grant that I became recipient of was one I didn't apply for. It's the FCA. You know, that's where they sort of stalk you for a bit. You don't know they're out there?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I'm sure people at the office, David Archuleta, my production people... I mean, I'm sorry, my development people know, but I don't know.
The FCA is an incredible grant where they watch you for a while, and you don't know you're being watched, and then you get a phone call... that you're a recipient of this grant. And what was tremendous about even receiving that grant was it came on the heels of a review that was just, you know, demolishing. And I felt it was really helpful, especially because that, and you and I have talked about this, that review was so laced with femphobia and... at the time, I just read as homophobia, and then a friend of mine who's trans actually went through the language and said this is femphobia. But in terms of, I think, the how to create more, but here we're talking about money and this idea of equity, like, and how...
Yes.
And how can that happen? And I'm not an administrator, and in terms of the projects I've done, I'm project-based. I was like, I am not going to be able to get a board together and know how to do that. I'm such an Aquarius. So I've been taken care of by teaching. I mean, it's all, in terms of the money I've made, it's all been through being a teacher. Oh. Whenever I had a show, I was just like, well, we're going to divide this evenly. And I remember, I think it was, there's two choreographers who I remember being like, I know, but honey, you did a lot of work before those rehearsals. Were you paying yourself for that?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. But that came because I was a performer first. Mm-hmm. I was a performer first, and I wanted it to have the equity that I felt I had wanted as a performer. But anyhow, so Bill, where you are?
I think we diverged from this document.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I don't remember what the name of it was.
It's called New Futures, and there's another word I'm missing. Exploring New Futures or something that it's called. And there's about 10 people that put it together. Emily Johnson, supposedly it came from a letter that something she posted on Instagram about her feelings of being misused with cancellations. And it led her to begin to think about the whole architecture of the field and how the artists are at the mercy of presenters and that the presenters are at the mercy of funders. It's quite a lot. I mean, I required my dancers to read the first 46 pages, which was just the history and the contextualization, and then a lot of firsthand testimonials. And now I'm reading about the organizational, from the point of view of technical people, from funders, from whatever. It's, I guess one of the people who was in the regular compilers is, I believe, a man who works at as an administrator at University of UMass. So it's trying to be very, very inclusive, and it has said it. The people defining it have said, we know that this is not speaking to everybody yet. They say we do this on behalf of those artists who see themselves in a category of experimental. And they say, but this is not addressing the needs of commercial artists. And I guess in that is also ballet companies. They say that the next stage of it, they hope this document is handed off to another group of persons who will go through it for language and insights from other points of view. And that someday it should be a document that's useful in negotiations in, they didn't say ballet, but I think they meant ballet world and the commercial theater. So you can see they have a big, big vision. Big vision.
Yeah.
And of course it will affect government, local and federal government, in terms of how arts are distributed, and it will affect the whole culture of philanthropy. This is the hope. So it's fascinating reading. Depending on where you're sitting, it can be very frustrating reading. It can seem very, there's that word, privileged. You know, it can seem very young, but it seems very necessary.
I want to. I think I was thinking of a different article. In this moment, I'm trying to read everything all at once, and I think there does need to be time for each, and real as we talk about in an academic setting, deep reading. You know that I don't just read something and then not incorporate it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Say that again. Deep reading for you is...
Deep reading is that when I read it, that I actually take the time to incorporate it, and I don't just read and move on to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had your dancers read it, how did you...
We have a check. We have a weekly check-in. And the weekly check-in, my truly enlightened associate artistic director, Janet Wong... She takes care of the business, because when we were interrupted at Mass MoCA in our tech for Deep Blue Sea, the Armory Commission, the whole world, just for me, went kaplooey, and we were like this video crew there, all the collaborators finally in one room, and sorry, we have to close down. And came home, and for a week I couldn't do anything except deal with the reality that, oh my God, my work was stopped. My work. And then we heard that it was going to be canceled. So in the meantime, what are we doing? At that time, of course, a lot of us, I don't know how you felt, we thought there was going to be maybe a month at the most, remember? And that, okay, after a month, we'll get back to normal. And a month turned into two, and so on. But Janet, from the beginning, said, oh, no, no, we've got to keep, I know we're going to all be social distance, but the dancers need assignments. And so she did that. I thought, Janet, are you crazy? But, you know, they're like someone's little apartment in the East Village. And she sent out tapes that, because a lot of them are very young. And, okay, they're in this company that has some recognizability, if not notoriety. And so do they know what Bill and Arnie looked like dancing together? Do they know what Bill was like when he was really dancing? Do they know what the themes were? So she found solos and she tried to focus it all on work that came from me. Because, you know, I don't really make the movement. I haven't really made movement for probably 15 years. I make some, but the dancers generate and she's great. But then they had an opportunity to see this and they have to videotape themselves doing it. And there's even something we have called Then and Now. And it shows, for instance, Odile Reine Adelaide, this beautiful shaven head woman who used to dance with me, doing a solo from Still Here called Slash, Poison and Burn, which is very, very virtuosic, very difficult, and very emotional, next to my 23-year-old Naya. Naya is a beautiful young black woman, and she's now trying to learn in her a room what Odile was doing almost 20 years ago. And Janet edited them together just to show, as I say, material trying to find its way into another era and into another body. So that's been our assignment. So we check in once a week and we talk about those things. And when Janet and Veronica Falburn, our very important
person,
who
I also love so much.
Isn't she wonderful?
I love Janet and I love Veronica so much. And Janet and Veronica and Kyle took care of me. Like, I can't even, Bill. I can't. It's a separate discussion, but yeah.
But you'll have to listen to them because I am a bit of a bulldozer, which I think you probably recognize as well. And I can be so involved in what I'm feeling that I don't. Mm-hmm. They say, well, hey, check in. Ask them, how are you doing? And then people briefly tell you how they're doing. Then after that, a little housekeeping from Kyle Maude about what the tour in the fall is like, what is and what is not. And now let's talk about something else. And that something else, I hope, would be discussions around the aesthetics of the company. Can you look at those two guys, that funny looking smaller guy, that preening tall black guy, and seeing what they were doing at the kitchen or at Performance Space 120, the Dance Space back 40 years ago. Do you have any relationship to that? And right. some of them you could see, like, actually they have none. And they've not been taught that they should even know about this work. And now I'm saying, is there any relationship in your well-trained body to what those guys were doing, gymlot gymnastics, you know, that sandlot gymnastics and so on. And it's been fascinating. Yeah, that is very important. And I was going to say that right now, the twin pandemic, the other one, well, as my sister or someone said in another call, we're trying to pull together a family Zoom from an exploded family. I don't know about your family. Trying to, at this time, I'm saying, okay, enough with the alienated artist thing, Bill. Enough of the alienated gay artist thing, Bill. These people, many of whom you don't speak to because fundamentalist Christian or what have you, they don't know what the hell you do. They don't know what it is. Can you be around the table with them and can you build a new family tradition? Out of that comes some very painful realities. I had little nieces tell me, voting? Well, in my church, they tell us be in the world, but not of the world. Don't vote. Okay, this is black people saying, right?
Whoa.
Or young black males who will not come to the meeting. First of all, because the old folks are running it. And yeah, y'all always telling us to go vote. You got celebrities, rap artists, and all these politicians telling us to go vote. You know, yeah, you did this in the 1960s, freedom, but look, they're still killing us now. Why should we vote? Wow, how do you get your hands around that? Now that's my family, you know? So it has been a learning experience. And I am full of it right now. I was crying before I picked up the phone for you because of related issues, right? People are angry. I am angry speaking to someone who I should be embracing, I'm cursing at. And feeling like I've got to be the elder. I mean, you're 41. You're sort of between being the hot baby and being the elder. I am elder. You know, you know, where are you guys at? Are you, what, I'm talking about niece, but
yeah, well, all the listeners know,
yeah,
where
the
we
listeners
are.
Know where we are. And
so
actually,
we're more curious.
I have, I want to break it down a little bit because I knew about the work that you were working on for the Armory.
Deep Blue Sea.
Deep Blue Sea, which was with, and it was a collaboration, right?
Well, it's always a collaboration. I was working with Liz Diller, of Diller, Scafidio and Renfro, and Peter Negrini. And Nick Hallett. Nick Hallett is doing the music. Or
I love Nick.
Yeah.
I have known that queen for years. I have known that queen for years. Well, because I got to see the piece that Nick did with you when I was teaching at ADF.
Dora. Dora or Les.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first one.
Yeah.
Dora.
Yeah.
Dora. And you know, Dora, she just died. Yeah. She died at the top of this thing. And so it's very difficult for my husband, Bjorn.
I'm so sorry.
Well,
please send my condolences to Bjorn.
We say that it was sad, but I don't want to see it as tragic. For him, the thing that hurt him the most was she's in Paris, his younger brother is there. They couldn't, even if he had been in Paris, they were not allowed to see her because of COVID.
Right.
And on a floor with 80 some people, I think. All of them died, but two or so. I'm maybe exaggerating, but so we don't know what her last moments were like. Ronnie said that she was calm and she was clean, unlike, as you know, some of the nightmares of other nursing homes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, it's
and
been
so
real.
My extreme condolences about that. And I loved that piece. But this work, so here you are now with it being realized, and it's at Mass MoCA. And
we're teching it at Mass MoCA, teching it. Ready to premiere it.
What date was this?
We left Mass MoCA on March 12th, 13th. And the piece was supposed to be premiered, am I right? Was it late April? I believe it was supposed to have been premiered and run for 10, 12 performances. So you can imagine how that felt when that clock we saw, oh, today would be the day we were in tech. This would be the dress rehearsal. This would have been such and such.
And two extreme years of your life.
Two very extreme years. But the good news is they did decide at the Armory that with some adjustments, they will reprogram it for next spring somewhere. Now, that was when I heard that news, I was weeping as well. And I don't know how you feel. There's so much, Jack, you know, when I look at you, there's so much I want to talk to you about, you know.
I'm here to talk about all of it, and we can talk as much here and also anytime offline, because Bill, there has been a lot that I've wanted to talk with you about that I didn't feel was my place right now. So,
Well, I'm a bit of a son of a bitch, but I'm also available son of a bitch.
You are, and I felt that when we got to have our sit down. You are, and also Bill.
It was fun. Wasn't it?
And it was so fun. I'm not going to get into the specifics of this, but the message that you gave me in 2019, when I was going through something,
I remember that.
I cannot thank you enough for showing up to me and giving me that message, and you helped me a lot. And why I wanted us to talk today is because I wanted to hear where you are, what's going on. I'm really sorry to hear about that with the project. Did Mass MoCA say they're going to do reprogramming?
Well, they were just for the site of the tech. Because, you know, the Armory is a son of a bitch. It's a huge space.
Huge.
Where do you find another place
field.
On the planet? Yeah, the whole planet.
Yeah,
where do you find a place? So we were rehearsing out at Mana, you know, out in Jersey City. We did a lot of rehearsals there. And the only other place that we could find the technical facilities would have been at Mass MoCA. They were really sweet and they hated it. You know, when we left, they were closing the museum down. But all is not lost because they are reprogramming it.
Okay. Yeah. They're going to reprogram it at the Armory, and then we'll Kyle will figure it out. Kyle and Veronica will figure out where you're going to do this tech before it goes in there. Well,
that's a
or
very
did you
good
feel
question.
You got enough? Did you feel you got enough done when you were at Mouse Mocha to?
Well, budget.
Right
now, if you understand that a piece is coming back, but you have to shave off yet again a considerable amount. All those groovy ideas you found that last day. Oh my God, this is great. We should have a pink light here and we should have those words. And then, project over. And we got to go back. How much is the pink light going to cost considering we've had to lose this much money? How about this? So on and so forth. All of that is up in the air. But, you know, now we're supposed to say something about being artists and we're resilient and we know how to work around obstacles, right, Jack?
Absolutely. And at the same point, you know, I was on a phone call with a friend and there's also something that I think is important to, that grief is real and getting to have, you know, this thing of just power through when you're going to muscle through. I think that can really create a lot of, at least for me, create a lot of burnout. Instead of having some, allowing myself to have some time to grieve, to have feelings, to be hurt by things that have happened, artistically, whether that's critically, fiscally, etc.
May I ask you a question about that, Jack? As you know right now, one of the things that the people younger than you are saying is mental health is just as important as your tendus.
Right.
You know, and I'm thinking, tell Miss Graham that. Tell Mr. Balanchine that. You know, I don't feel it today. The world is too heavy. I can't make rehearsal today. I mean, imagine. Can you imagine? You know? But now the young folks are telling us, oh, no. It is just as important. So how, may I ask you, you're a veteran in these wars. How are you dealing the emotional and the vicissitudes of this profession? Do you have words of wisdom for choreographers coming behind you? How have you done it?
I am going to steer it back to you, but I do appreciate that question. And the first piece I made when I was 21, and the emotional blowback of showing material that I was psychologically unprepared for, which was about trauma. I was not prepared. And so I took a big, long break away from making work and got myself a therapist. And when I teach and when I work with my students, I suggest to them that they don't put things up in front of the audience that they have not worked through. Mm. Because if you get bullied about that, it'll hit you in a way. So I'm coming up on 18 years with my therapist. It's the longest relationship of my life.
Wow.
and who deals specifically with trauma and as also can relate to politics because he is a Cuban refugee.
They come together, so, don't they?
I have a question that for both of you, actually. Jack is an educator and Bill T is both an educator and a leader in an arts organization. But it is going back to this question of young people demanding more thought be put into their emotional health, their mental well-being. And I think I'm like Jack, I lie in this point where I understand both, but I probably relate more to a kind of value in routine and value in commitment to a thing that you place yourself in. So sometimes I don't have a lot of compassion for people who are like, you know, I find this triggering, my mental health takes precedent, I need to not be here. Because I still feel like if I commit to something, if I commit to a routine, it's not really my place to then make a choice about how I need it to be structured for me. I need to then commit to it and experience it as it's being presented to me. And so I'm curious about your thoughts
And that is a question that could, you know, you put your pinky in the hole and suddenly your whole arm goes in. But I'll take a chance, and I don't want to say anything that has angry letters coming in, but I come from a kind of school of hard knocks. I was taught that on every level, you know, that you have got, art making is a privilege, not a right. Now that's a big one. I haven't had a public discussion about that. It's a privilege and not a right. Therefore, if you are in this class of people defined as artists, you're already defining yourself some way, in some ways outside the rules. Now, for that kind of freedom, what are you willing to give up? And now you might say, why should I have to give up anything? Why doesn't the world come out and take care of me? Because I'm what I do is so valuable. And I feel like, how do you say that? Listen, dear. How did Susan Sontag, and I hope I don't misquote the goddess, she said something to the effect of a commencement address, oh, I don't know, I'm going to say 20 years ago. She said, a thing I have understood, and the Sontag scholars will correct me here, the purpose of it is not to be happy. Now, she was talking about the whole shebang, life. The purpose of life is not right. to be happy.
Right.
And now you think, okay, well, if that's not to be happy, then what is it? Now, that makes for a lot of, you could go wrong with that, right? I do want happiness. That's why I married this man I'm living with. That's why I married him. That's why I want to not be ashamed of being a middle class, middle age. Well, I'm an old homosexual living, looking out of a beautiful garden right now. No, I feel my parents were potato pickers. My parents, when I went off to college, they had nothing to give me. We were on welfare. I was able to get grants. I went to the university, behaved like the white kids did, smoked pot, dropped acid, did all that stuff. But there was a sense, unfortunately, thank God for Arne Zane, this very talented, angry Jewish man who wanted what was owed to him in this world, including this African-American who he loved dearly. And he was fierce, right? And he was gonna, and we had to have plans, and we had to shoot for this and that. And quite frankly, we didn't expect the world to give us anything. Now, funny, because I'm a black person of a certain generation. The only reason I was able to go to the university was because of a liberal Congress at that time, that there was discretionary cash for people like me, the underclasses, to go to the university. But you know, underneath it, we felt, you know what? You turn your back and those motherfuckers are going to lynch you. They're going to rape you. They're going to bully you. Hell, man. They're going to like run their cars over you. So if you got in there, you do whatever you have to do. You take that shirt off, Bill T. Jones, when you have to. You smile and bat your eyes and wag your ass when you need to. You are one of them that they allowed in. Here is that they. Who is this they we're talking about, right? At that time, we didn't have the words for they. If they allow you to have your mug on the front of what used to be DTW, and now it is a place that you have come in with your organization, and now it's called New York Live Arts, wear that with responsibility and pride and work for it. And are you willing to even die for it? That used to be what I said. When I came into 80, when we moved down here from Binghamton in the early 80s, and we went to see, I think it was Linda Nylon, some cool downtown place, and everybody was in black, and everybody, and I was being on my high horse, and I said to my friend Joe Hannon, who used to work at the Kitchen, composer, I said, yeah, I see what they're doing, but what would they die for?
Right.
And somebody said, hey, hold up, Bill, what do you mean what they die for? Why aren't you asking what would they live for? Mm. So I don't know if I'm answering your question about that. I cannot say that in good conscience to young people right now without sounding like an asshole, an old curmudgeon. But you know what? It's my company.
Not at all.
Well, I also, Bill, I think there's something in that that I think, Reed, to quickly answer your question, it's very different how I speak to my students than what I'm going to require from people who I'm working with. Those are in totally different paradigms. And with my students, it is about psychological preparation for what my experience has been as a working professional, where I have had to, so what I ask for my students is to come up with one sentence they can remember quickly for why they do what they do. Mine is so that people don't feel so alone. And I've needed that sentence because I knew I was going to get slammed, both critically, financially, all sorts of things. And it would end that if those things got in my way, it would deter me from my primary purpose, which is to be of service. So the thing though that I love in hearing from you, Bill, because something that I as a Scorpio rising really have is I can be very chained to my grief and very chained to what would I die for? And it it's meant so much to ever hear someone say, but what would I live for?
Mm-hmm.
And where is the joy? I, like you, I grew up in a way that if I was going to get out, it was going to have to happen sheerly by scholarship. Mm. And it meant that I had to be the best and that I had to continue to lily pad my way forward. And it always felt like I was jumping in midair to another place in midair.
Did you feel, Jack, that they will tie your hands and feet and lynch you if you give them the means to do so? They hate what you are. Now,
where I grew up, I was intensely, I was bullied and there was a lot of violence and I was very targeted. And so unfortunately for me, what it meant is that I had to, and this is before I left rural Wisconsin, I had to become really mean. And I had to know how to fight back. And, I was thinking about Stokely Carmichael because when I was first reading about Martin Luther King, and I felt very confused by this idea of nonviolence, and that's what then took me to Stokely Carmichael. And then, with my students, it's about teaching them that. And then with the people that I work with, Reed, who knows this because we've worked together so much, since my work is coming out of trauma research and especially as it relates specifically for me with sexuality, gender, and class disparity, I don't want it to re-traumatize my performers. So I try to create a container and a space that will allow for them to be as vulnerable and to feel a sense of some kind of egalitarian process, even though I am making the moves. I'm like, these are the moves, and I'm writing the script. And I frequently, because of funding, am also lighting the lights. And also, the main collaboration is Reed, who does the costumes, or if I'm working with a visual artist for the set.
And I really enjoyed reading more about your path, Reed. But this question of one of the challenges that we did someone mention the other night, at this town hall meeting, the myth of the genius choreographer, the myth of the genius, and that we must dismantle it.
And of the individual, I mean, what I took from that was of the individual artist, of this idea that of kind of only of ushering and supporting solely behind certain selects, and that how can we, in terms of, and I really, and it, I felt shocked by this statement of that there's enough in the nonprofit. I don't function in administration. I only know what it's like to apply for grants and to be rejected from them, except for I did receive one for Dance in Process, and then organizations have applied for grants for me. Like that's something that Abrams did that, because I thought I was writing good grants, but clearly not. So this was what they were bringing up was how can we become more of a community by having there not just be certain selects that a majority of capital traffics to?
Yes.
But does this beg the question, should all resources allocated to art making be dispersed equally? Or do we choose those people who are making things that are maybe more provocative, more needed, et cetera? I don't know the answer to
that. I don't know the answer to that. And I would also push back on that, Reed, and say that I frequently have seen capital, and Bill, you, I'm sure, can agree with this. I have seen capital go actually to things that are not provocative, that are incredibly safe, and that give a kind of entertainment more to the status quo.
First of all, I don't know if we want to go into something the edgier things have more value and what have you. How does Jenny Holzer, there's one of her truisms from the 80s, all that is new is interesting. And I think she said that with a wink, right?
Right. That was, I believe that was ironic.
Yes.
It also presupposes that there's new.
Yes. And see, what I think is important right now, and this is a conversation I have with my dancers, with this statement, art making is a privilege, not a right, came the question of value and expertise. Who and merit. Who decides what gives the value? That's, and Jack, here we go with this question about criticism and all, right? Who decides? And every artist who has ever felt that he didn't get a grant or felt cheated in some way, a poor review or what have you, an unfair review, can say that the system is rigged and that they're only, is rigged to get me.
Right.
And, you know, look, I'm a black gay man, right? So I know something about this, but I don't dare at this point allow myself to go there. I have to believe, because I know that I am a judgmental person. I know that I have taste. I know that I have a set of values. And if I am in a position at a foundation or what have you to give money, am I going to give to money blindly? I don't know if anyone's saying that. We're speaking very general terms. Or am I going to have criteria?
Right.
And I think that the question on the table right now is, get rid of you, the funder. Why do we have to have you people lording over us? Why do we have to have presenters? Let artists run the whole thing. Now, that sounds like pie in the sky, but then again, oftentimes visionary language is pie in the sky when it starts. So I have enough humility to know that maybe I'm living in a time when people are really going to, we don't need to fight the Russian Revolution again, right? We don't need to the end of history and all of that. Do we need to take apart all of the system and build new ones up that are egalitarian, without judgment, without, I mean, I don't believe it's going to happen, but then again, I'm the old guy. I didn't think it would happen, you know, that I would live to be at a time where I have to say, you know, Bill, maybe you have to just sit down. You sit down and let those young people work it out.
I'm still unpacking the election in 2016 shook me so much about the very question of meritocracy. And I do not feel I can speak about the arts without looking at the larger social picture. And Bill, that is clearly through all of your work. That your work is very, and it's why I've loved it, is because what I've wanted is work that mirrors what is.
But very personal, right? Did you trust this narrator? This narrator has a specific experience, social location. Can he be trusted to be a policymaker? Or is he just one other hungry artist out there trying to promote an idea? There's a whole class of policy, isn't there? There's a whole class of people that we want to mandate they be that. That's the idea. But you think otherwise, that we don't need that class of guardians and tastemakers?
Oh, for that, and, I think, I mean, I'm still, the election brought, in terms of meritocracy, that's a question that I feel it demolished a sense of, for me, it demolished meritocracy. And I am here, and then it brought up a question of, okay, well, what happens where, you know, Maria Goyanis, who is at the Public?
Yes, she and I've met her, but I don't know her, no.
She's at Woolly Mammoth now, but she came and spoke at Bard, and I remember her talking about working on Hamilton, and I had known producers on Hamilton, and she was talking about the making of it, and this idea of when you make something, considering that you need to consider how many people it's for. And that shook me as an artist, because I realized that I wasn't asking that question and that my work was based on who needs it. And that therefore, when I was like, why am I not touring and blah, 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 it was like, well, that's on me, actually. And because
Whoa, how is that? That's a bit self-flagellating, isn't it, Jack?
Well, I feel I've made work that is very, that has a lot to do around trauma. I mean, it's trauma as it deals with gender, sexual orientation, and class. And so I also think it's a big ask to ask people to leave their homes and come and either reflect, be instigated. I mean, I try to use, as you've seen, humor. I try to use...
which you do very well.
Lots of... I'm like the opposite of Yvonne Rainer's No Manifesto.
Yes.
I try to use all of that to lure people into it. And but it did bring up this I thought, oh, well, I haven't been thinking about everyone. I've been thinking about this. And maybe that's why my work is where it's at in terms of its touring and its viewership.
Are we having a discussion now about the populism question?
Yes, I would be up for that.
Well, I don't know. I think we're you just like stepped into it. I feel that as I say sometimes about my work, I and my mother. My mother is a hero in a way, but my mother was a deeply convinced Christian and Baptist, Southern Baptist. I say that I have the infrastructure of a Southern Baptist without the faith. Mm. So I believe that if I can get the spirit going in the room, I can lift the room up and be lifted with it. Now, what gets the spirit moving in the room? They could be tricks of showmanship. They could be just the most, like you got this stuff. You know about the costumes. You get the most beautiful performers. All of those things are designed. I think it's because you love them, but you're also designed to win, to seduce.
Yes.
Is there anything wrong with that? If at the end of the day, that piece, and I don't think anything's wrong with it.
Right.
Now, I think one of the things that in our field, now we're in a different world than when Yvonne was developing that, and she's even moved past it, but it's what I'm here about, how many people? The question is, who are you making the work for?
Right.
And is that fair to ask any artist? Because artists say, you know, I'm making the work for people who are maybe not even born yet.
Right.
I'm making the work for people who are coming from such an outside perspective. In other words, the artist cannot know their audience. Do you think that's true? Artists know their audience?
I actually do think that's true. And it was from Everything Is Imaginable where I really learned that, because you had an audience member write me. Who had won a ticket to seeing the show through the lottery, and she began her email saying, I know you make your work for queer people, but I want you to know, as a straight woman who's been a doctor for the last 30 years.
She got it, right?
She said, you know, my husband died 2 years ago and I haven't been able to grieve, and this show helped me do that.
I remember that, yes.
And that was that really opened it up. And also, yes, why I wanted to speak to you. Another thing that I do want to get to, and I want to speak to, Bill, is you have lived through major crises before. You have lived through a pandemic that was also charged politically. And I wanted to, and you've made work on it, you've spoken on it so much. And I was wondering where, as we're looking at the landscape today, what things you are remembering from it and that you feel inspired and could tell us and our listeners from that.
Well, it's a big sprawling question and we need several conversations. But the one thing I ask, and I ask it with a barely concealed edge. HIV/AIDS was a guilty disease. It was guilty. COVID. Mm. Is COVID a guilty plague? And now that's a good place I like to start.
Right.
You know, because some people say COVID was just telling us that we've got to consume less. We've got to slow down. We have to respect the planet more. So yeah, we deserved it, right? Remember? If you've
deeply.
Been in bathhouses, you know, sucking dicks and being fucked and all that, and exchanging fluids and so on and so forth. Yeah. Well, you had it coming.
Right.
You're living outside the natural law.
Right.
Guilty disease. Is COVID a disease that's not guilty? I cannot answer that. I think everybody would now, I want them to look back at AIDS. And the question is, we were told we should not have unprotected sex. No way. I don't think I knew one heterosexual person who was really paying attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, because they know they were, even though we're saying we all are connected through our body fluids and blood, that was very clear that, you know, as long as I don't fuck with a guy, I can continue. I don't have to change my behavior. We now see the COVID the curve is leveling out in New York. I think before this latest violence and the social justice protests, when people are It's my brother, who is a cop who lives in Las Vegas. He sent out a very laconic text message. He said, those kids who are breaking those windows, are they social distancing? You know, I mean, it was like two different languages. So what is there to learn? Life hurts like hell. You are not special. Life can be beautiful. I've seen deathbeds that are like, you cannot believe what happened in a deathbed. And people can rise to any situation. Are you a person that can do that? What do you really love? What do you really love? What do you love? I love the truth. All right. Well, get out there then and make truth. Like Jack, he says, I believe that people can be comfort and be together. Get out there and make the fucking work that does that. I believe that I have the right to be an elder in somebody's life. I think I have the right to actually help and communicate information. If that's the case, then Bill T, this is what age has taught me. You're still around. Do you know how to articulate what it means? What it really means to help someone. We're born, we grow. If we're lucky, we meet another human being, we meet them, we create new life, we go into a decline, and just like the leaves that fall from the trees, we will die. Nobody gets out of here alive. Now that became, you gotta realize when people your age are 41, Arnie Zane died, I believe he was just barely 40. And there were people, I don't need to tell you, we've been through it, right? I've met kids, 16, 17, 18, right? Already with Kaposi sarcoma, right? Oh, I know. So this fucking world is crazy. How could there be a God that could let this happen? Hey, maybe you got to rethink of what you think God's here for. And maybe you got to rethink of what we're here for. Now, if you want joy, make joy. Make goddamn joy. As Maya Angelou used to say, if you want hope, you already have it. Is that glib? No, I don't think it's glib. Those of us who struggle with depression know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
What keeps me alive this night so I don't open the vein?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot. But is this a guilty disease? Is this a guilty plague? And what do we do with that? This idea that we're culpable? Or is that a useless question? It certainly wasn't useful when they were beating gay men over the head with it back in the day. Or that other underclass drug users.
Right.
I mean, I think it's a useful question in recontextualizing what AIDS means to the people who lived through it and maybe don't have an understanding about it. I think that this COVID is a disease now that can help people to shift their narrative around what AIDS was about as they now see people who they know and love affected by something as arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you ever deal with the Schadenfreude? You know, when I see sometimes the young folks stripped and ready on the beaches in Miami and they're going out there or COVID parties and so on, you know, and I'm thinking, God damn it. You know, in a year's time when this thing comes back around and you're in the hospital or someone you love in the hospital, I wait to see that. That's an evil thought, right? I think Schadenfreude is always evil, I think. But it's something I feel. You think that you're that free? You're that fierce?
That thought I don't think is necessarily evil. I think there's a lot about what revenge and an ask for people to see things that they have that their life's been so privileged. They were to the manor born.
Mm. You literally mean economically?
It can begin there, sure. Mm-hmm. But then there can be a lot of other things around it, like...
Oh, yes. Right.
Which really obviously go into race and then also zones of, as you already said, class.
Who used the condom and who didn't use the condom?
Right.
Right?
Right.
who wears a mask and who doesn't wear a mask. Okay, I know it's complicated, but they're related in my mind.
Completely.
Yeah.
And then also this, and I'm also curious in terms of looking back of, I mean, because also when that was happening and the, and what resources were going to white people with HIV AIDS, and how were black people, people of color, especially if we, then we think of our trans brothers and sisters, how were they being treated through this? And,
you know, Jackie, you're pointing to something which is very important coming to this talk today. I said, I'm going to go sit and talk to my gay brothers today, right? I have tried, not even consciously, but I noticed that I am not looking at you as white men. I'm trying to, and I'm thinking, oh, well, hey, this is the time where I should be coming in here and preaching the gospel about what white men should know. This, I don't know what I'm even saying here other than it's really hard, the racial lesson that's being taught right now. Because, you know, for me to accept that there is this kind of lesson, oh my God, Bill, you have been living in a fool's paradise. You believe Martin Luther King when he said, free at last, free at last. That we will all take hands and like little children sing. You believe that. My nephews, I told you in the South, they say, yeah, we're not going to vote. We don't believe it. They're still killing us. I said, you've lost the faith. Do I believe that there's something intrinsically different in your experience and in my experience that is rooted in our skin? I couldn't say no. Do you? I mean, you're supposed to say, yes, I see, Bill. I feel your pain. You know, that's the new, as John McWhorter says, that's the new religion now. White people who saying, I'm sorry, I see my privilege. Mm. This is a black intellectual, you know, John McWhorter? Yeah, yeah. You might be interested, yeah. But he says that I get calls from people crying that they've just come to this realization. And he says, you know, don't take it wrong way, but I'm not concerned about white people feeling bad.
Right.
I want to know what the results here for black people.
Completely. I think I do believe I think that that sentiment is absolutely, I think for white people to be that have all of a sudden been surprised that there that racism exists, that's a big shock. And I think and how shocking, right? And especially in some neo-lib context. And then also but yes. Then you go ahead and, you know, and you read Angela Davis and you think okay, but this was, or actually I really think of, you know, Butler and Gender Trouble when we start talking about like who's getting marked.
But how is the gay community doing now? It used to be, when you said gay community, you of course meant the buff vanilla that was on the cover of The Advocate. Mm-hmm. That's when it was back in the day. And all the black, because I'm just now able to say queer. I'm just now, you know? Now, do not call me fucking queer. I will fucking punch your fucking eyes out. No, it's an empowerment, Bill. We've accepted this language.
It meant something very different for you and me. That word was very different word.
How do you think the gay culture is doing around race now? How is the
not
gay
as good
doing?
As I would like it to be.
But you know, with me, with class, though, Jack, we don't lose the class thing, is I thought that, once again, it is something Darwinian about it. The reason that we were, when I was a child, I could still hear my grandmother, through my mother, don't burn books. You never burn a book. And I didn't understand what that was until I realized it was a time when we weren't allowed to be educated, allowed to read. Right. So, I'm going to assimilate into the middle class. I'm the one who said, particularly my angry moments about the downtown, I said, I feel like I am in some outpost full of refugees from the middle classes. And that was at refugees, poor, because I went to school with them. They're so disillusioned with the rules of the middle class. They're so disillusioned. They want to go to some outpost where they can be truly authentic and so on. And here I am, you know, on welfare. And everyone's talking about dropping out and going off to Woodstock and all. What the hell? Are you dropping out? You can't even get in, man. You know that? So once you do get in there, You better be middle class. You better get in there. Now, can you stay middle class and not lose? And now this is a question for you. Do you think that with your class, your underclass, there's some essential, important aspect of yourself that is at the risk of being erased if you accept middle class? Is that what's behind this question of class? Is that you believe to accept the privileges, if you will, the potentials, if you will, that there you're going to have to pay on the other side, and you feel guilty about that?
Like some deal with the devil. It's
Well, you know, I look at my heroes. When I look at heroes, like I hear John Coltrane blow. I hear Billie Holiday sing. I hear Louis Armstrong. Those people were geniuses, boom. And they were also gig artists. They wanted to be paid. They wanted that house in Scarsdale or wherever. They wanted all of that, right? And Maya Angelou used to talk about, well, Maya's come up a lot, when people from PETA, and I believe, I don't mean to criticize PETA, would be coming up to she or Gladys Knight all wearing their furs, those ladies in their furs. And they say, you know, you shouldn't be wearing that. And Maya would say, well, I told them, I said, look, when you all had, it was all right when you wore furs, but now that I'm able to wear them, you're going to tell me I shouldn't? Now, those are conversations that are missing. Are they two different conversations? What is that? Those of us who are refugees from the lower classes, who have been allowed into the middle class and upper class, and you got the talent, you can go anywhere you want to in this business, you know, and those of us, how do we feel about our narrative? And how are we able to, without guilt, punish ourselves, but also build and keep that ladder so people can climb up? This has been very difficult for me as a self-involved artist. I am getting a message that I have to stop soon because I think I have another call. Is there anything else we want to wrap up? Let me see what...
Well, but what I'm curious about that, the main thing that I wanted to just be able to hear from you today was in looking back on your life and considering where we are now and just to take in any message that you might have to give us and to give our listeners.
Well, let me, I think these are.
And I feel you have given some.
I know, I talk a lot, and I hope that you edit this out so I don't.
As I said, Bill, I only want more, okay. And I'm gonna.
Well, going from the era of Still Here, when I was out speaking to people who had or had been dealing with life-threatening illness, and I asked them, how did you do it? And they would say, live in the moment, cherish small things. You must have a higher sense of purpose in your life. Does that mean God? I don't know what. And then, what is your community? Now, they would always say that. That's how they were able to make it. Some of them are not alive now, but that's how they were able to get there. And I stand behind those four things. I think that's, and particularly that, live in this moment, cherish small things, reach out. And this is hard for a self-involved and wounded artist. Can you be a part of a community?
Bill, thank you. I want to briefly just say to you, Bill, and I said this to you before, when I was an early art maker, I was on that panel and we were all complaining, why don't we have enough? And this man stood up and said, everyone who had helped you died of AIDS and stormed out, didn't talk to us. And I want to thank you for being a survivor who helps, for being someone who shows up. I spent this past year listening to interviews through the AIDS Oral History Project. I spent a lot of time with Arnie's archive. I spent a lot of time getting to know you vis-a-vis that, and I want to thank you.
I wish he knew you. I wish he knew you. My God, now that's
Bill,
what it is.
I cried so hard when I listened to his. Linda Murray was holding me. He said so many things that I felt. When he said, I wish I made dances like Lucinda Childs, I cried because I wish I was that queen too. And I'm just not. I just am not. And I love him. I miss him.
Oh,
I wish,
man,
I could have met him.
Do.
And I am honored to know you and to get to know him through you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Jonah.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you again. Bill is gone now. We're doing an unusual thing where we're going to talk a little bit beyond the interview. because there is just too much to say, and we didn't get a chance to really wrap everything up with Bill as he had to leave. But it was an exceptional interview, and you know, just to be clear, you know, Jack and Bill, and you can speak to this, you guys have like a very interesting relationship because you've worked with Nyla, and which requires you to have some kind of dialogue with Bill.
Well, Bill and I had done an interview when I was there, and I got to talk with him some then. And then we also had a couple phone calls that where he's just was very supportive around something that I was going through, and actually that you and I were going through. And so yes, and then I spent, as I already said to him, all of this time this past year, I mean not all of this time, but a fair amount of time with Arnie's archive.
Right. Right. And I just want to say, I think at some point in the conversation, I do call into question or raise the question about the sensitivity of younger people and in the arts, and what level of sensitivity should we be taking towards young people entering into this field as educators, et cetera. And I want to say that I do have an amount of compassion and sensitivity towards those people, particularly people who come from marginalized communities. I think my issue in this situation comes up a lot from stories that you tell me about how students in this day and age have various sensitivities to things. And it's hard for me to hear that, particularly when they're students who come from so much privilege that they enter into academic environments with expectations about how they should be taught. But that's, you know, my own issue, especially coming from, you know, very, very specified and regimented kinds of academic arts environments.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like, obviously, a different decade. It's a different century, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So I just want to say, like, I do have compassion around these topics. It's just, I, you know, in the way that Bill was able to speak on being an elder and being somebody who is now having to relearn and listen to people of a different generation, I similarly have, I have some of those feelings.
But I do find you, Reed, to be very, I feel you sell yourself short on that, because I've also heard you talk about things that you found really unjust. You're very just at things that you found very unjust in your experience as a dancer, that not only helped shape you in terms of not wanting to ever be that yourself, but I think stewarded you into wanting to actually have some agency over your life.
Yeah.
And to be a costume designer. And now you're going to grad school, which to me means that you then can go and teach. And what a gift. You know, and in talking with Bill, when we got off of the call, I really lost it, because I am always struck by that. I feel I'm reaching into nothing while reaching to the kids I'm teaching. Because of AIDS. The amount of people that AIDS took from us in terms of elders to look for and to, and to be guided by, there is no way that we will ever recover from that. And our generation is beset with trying to be something for a younger generation that we didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a huge task, and but I believe we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it, and I see it. Like, my students are, oh my God, they're so amazing, and the way they handled this past semester, and I just, and you and I have talked about this before on this podcast, when you looked at what it looked like in terms of the votes by age, I mean, come through.
Yeah.
Like, The children are the future, and they are showing up, and it is our responsibility to assist them as best we can.
But yeah. I do not think it is a conversation that can happen without the discussion of AIDS.
Right. I think another interesting thing that we talked about that I wanted to touch on is, you know, from the dance union's town hall, mm-hmm. there was this discussion around like there being enough resources, but it was just how they were being used that needed to be looked at and needed to yeah. be, there needed to be some kind of adjustment in that. And I think that that is probably true. And I think that our own perception to numbers and money can also shift because I didn't grow up with money, but my relationship to money is not tied up in feeling like I don't have any. I was always made to feel as if I was living a sort of worthwhile and interesting life. Mm-hmm. I at no point felt destabilized by a number amount. And right. I mean, I can, you know, I can owe that to my mother, I guess, for creating an environment in which I felt safe. And obviously, like to look at the life that I lived as a child and now as an art maker, you know, I've lived a very privileged existence, but it is a privilege that comes without money. And so there are many ways of looking at what to do with our resources. And I strongly believe that there should be more equal distribution of resources, but I do also believe, do you feel that there's a situation in which the money should be divided evenly amongst everybody and then we see what happens?
I definitely do fall more into the, you know, if there was a way for, you know, I was talking about this recently with someone about what if everyone just had the same income? I mean, that then we're talking about communism. And but how could that happen without a Castro situation? You know, right. how do you do that without the whoever the person in charge is still not making sure that they take care of the 1%, which is right. what happens in communist culture. So what we ended up finding out was that, you know, the people in power are hoarding the money and making sure that them and their friends are all still right. getting like private hospitals. So I do believe that if people's fundamental needs were met, that if everyone had a more equal income, that actually we would enter into, and this is so, you know, perhaps me as too much of an Aquarius, but this idea that we would enter into a new phase of living that would alter all forms of culture.
Yeah.
And our lives, because our lives would be taken care of. People wouldn't be afraid of hospital bills and of their livelihood.
And there are examples out there that really point to it being possible that artists be supported in a more even way and that there not be this kind of fear around not being able to pay bills or your mm-hmm. healthcare, et cetera. And mm-hmm. I think it's something interesting to aspire to. And I also see in looking at art that comes from those places, the downsides to that. Like when you look at a place like Sweden, when you look at a place where artists are really right. supported, you're like, well, I mean, there is of course some art coming out of these places that is worthwhile, that is interesting, but it does lack this kind of discussion that happens inside of a more tense environment.
Well, I think, but that's what's interesting, right, is this is also the notion of, and I mean, this is when it starts to really, this is when I feel like I switch gears from theoretical or political into spiritual, and then we get into Buddhism, and the first noble truth of that is that to be alive is to have suffering. And I think that then we get into more of this question of what's art for. And there's some people who want to feel I'm one of those people who wants to feel ventilated by and moved by work that has that edginess in it. But there's other people who really don't want that. And I think the thing that is curious inside of it is, so then how could those both exist? But how could there be capital behind material that is edgy and pushes boundaries, but also can exist outside of standardized categorical thinking?
Right.
That, because that's the other thing that we're going to see then, right? Is, I mean, because if you're bringing up these things of works that
have state funding, but then we start to see like they all look very similar.
Right. I mean, that, you know, if in fact there were a situation where suddenly everyone in the dance arts community were to start receiving, you know, national funding and everybody was put on a more even playing field, it would still, in America, there would still be decades of anger and tension that would be expressed through the work. We would certainly not be
lifetimes.
Lacking. We would not be lacking for that.
And to go back to AIDS, it is during the AIDS crisis that we had our that the culture wars happened. Mm-hmm. They are bonded together. They are hands. They're in the evil white hands of Ronald Reagan and Jesse Helms and all of those incredible evil sociopaths.
Yeah, those are people who believed so strongly in the antithesis of socialism that they caused homelessness in America, that they took away art in America. These are actually evil people who don't have any understanding of themselves, really. They don't have an understanding of humanity or how we should function as a society.
That was when you had artists like the NEA4, and what happened to them was that places on the left didn't want to support them anymore because they were afraid of losing their resources. It happened on both sides, and we're back to what we talked about in the beginning, like the left and the right. I mean, of course the right, but the left also was like, "Ooh, I'm worried. I guess we won't have Karen Finley come here." And I think that really needs to be examined and looked at. And so yes, when people are calling for artist equity, it's something I've always believed in and have tracked back. At least for me, in terms of the culture wars and AIDS, what happened inside of that. And yeah, these different niches that fight for each other and become really competitive. And that is a part of the dance world that I'm not interested in. When I came into the dance world, it was because of how fed up I felt with how much categorical thought I was experiencing in theater. Specifically around heterosexuality. And that I experienced a lot of, at that time I deemed it as homophobia, now I would deem it as femphobia. And I felt that there was more room in dance performance art. And it's interesting then when you're in there to see, oh, but there are, it's here too. There's this thing of, no escape. So then the thing that I liked that the dance union brought up is, well, how do we create places for these administrators to have transparency? And what do these administrators need? I'm an artist. I'm not an administrator. I don't want to work in arts admin. That's why, you know, that's probably why I don't ever get a grant. It's because my grants are probably really bad. Right. And
I'm not terribly involved in this universe of grant getting and giving, and I've applied for a couple myself and been lucky enough to work in such a niche part of this dance world that I have been awarded most of the things I apply for because we're kind of an underrepresented component of this field we work in. But in seeing how these grant structures work and so I suppose what they're looking for in terms of language, I think there hopefully should be some kind of dismantling of that moving forward, because it's so disingenuous to have to use all of these kind of trigger words in order to receive money. Mm-hmm. It's sort of absurd, actually.
And someone who I've heard speak so eloquently on that is Terry O'Connor. Also how the sort of fallacy of doing a pitch to an organization about a project that you're going to make in 2 years.
Exactly.
And how that also betrays what the very artistic process is, which is about finding, discovering, and research. I mean, that's live art. That's what we're involved in. And, but I'd also want films to be able to have that leeway, to have all arts have that leeway.
I was listening to an episode of The Dance Union, which is my new favorite podcast.
Huge shout out to them.
And Jay Bowie was talking about how, you know, he's been learning through repeated applications to various organizations about what it is that they're looking for. And rather than, at this point, try to cater his applications to these people, which would be disingenuous. He's like, I'm not going to apply to them anymore because, you know, they've made it abundantly clear to me that I'm not what they're looking for.
Yep.
And I was like, that is wise to like, what are you wasting? If you know that they're not looking for your product, do not then write a bunch of silly words to try to convince them otherwise.
And I am not going to call out these grant, like these granting bodies, but I remember going through that in my early 30s when I was applied to the ones that everyone told me to apply to. And then after my third attempt on each of them, I was like, I've tried three times, I'm letting go. And I remember Miguel being like, I remember Miguel saying like, look, if you want a Guggenheim, it like takes six times and blah, blah, blah. And I just, because I remember people saying, you have to start young. And I was like, well, I'm coming into this at, you know, at 27. So, and I'm trying to just plan out my rehearsals on and figure out how to do this show at Dixon Place on $3,000. And while I like get Pilates certified and have that secondary way of just getting some food on the table when I decided to leave acting, which I agree with Bill in that. That's a privileged decision to make. I always, I have never, and it's part of how I grew up. I didn't grow up with art. My experience was like through TV and film. I should have gone that route.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like if you feel so powerfully that it is your calling to work in the arts, you must come to it knowing that it will be a struggle.
Right.
And, you know, if that's not what you're looking for and you don't want to be engaged in that way and be a part of what can be and often is like an incredibly loving, compassionate, interesting community, then absolutely go be a ditch digger. I mean, it's honest work and it's reliable and it's steady.
It's really, I think the thing too that's imperative always to just say to artists is for to make sure that we are watching the news and seeing our place. I do believe in the efficacy of live art. I have felt its efficacy. And at the same time, it's, and do what you love.
But all this said, I believe that the speakers from the Dance Union Town Hall meeting are correct in saying that
there are
resources out there and, you know, there is enough for everybody. It's just,
I was really surprised in that thinking because I haven't worked in an arts admin before. And I've just instead have dealt with, this is all we have, or actually we have to cut your budget.
Right. It was eye-opening to hear them.
And to hear that people who've worked in arts administrations can speak to that there is enough if it was distributed equally. I was surprised. And I did think about, you know, those who, and we see this, right? We see someone get a grant and then they get all the grants that year.
Right. And I mean, I also heard Jay Bowie talking about this on the podcast as well. You know, there needs to probably be more transparency because I, as a person who comes in towards the end, who's a collaborator, sometimes my fees are greater than what the dancer would have made during the entire course of building a work.
Right.
So, you know, I participate in the inequity and I know that it exists. So I would definitely like there to be more transparency.
Well, and that was, I think, what was interesting for me inside of it. And it was amazing to see Bill's eyes open when I said that I haven't made money from my work, was because I've always paid the dancers the same fee that I get. I always split it amongst everyone. The only time when I got to not do that was during Chambre, because we had such extreme residency support that I actually got to pay myself for the time that I was alone working on the script.
I mean, Bill T. Jones is an exception to the rule. Right. I mean, he hustled and worked very hard for many years to create a really major reputation for himself, which then, you know, evolved into being the most decorated, celebrated Black dance artist ever.
Right.
There is nobody who's ever been in a situation like that. So obviously it would, you know, his lived experience in dance is very different than anything we could ever imagine.
Right. And I also just want to shout out the Dance Unions. It is Jay Bowie, but it's with Melanie Green, who's also, I've really loved hearing her
her as well, and hearing them together. It's a good, I hope that we can find a time when they can come on.
Yeah. They have really listened to their podcast. It's excellent.
Yep. Fully.
And they have over 50 episodes. So you have a long catalog to catch up on.
Yeah.
Although we're coming right up on our 3-year anniversary. I don't know when that is, but.
Oh my God, Reed, episode, we really are.
Episode 56 is, what episode are we? Who knows? But episode 56 will be our 3 years.
Episode 50. What do you mean episode 56? You mean 156? Oh, no,
Yes, 156.
Is that how many we've done?
I think we're very, we're just about
there. I can't. It's really, it is a lot. I mean, wow, what an oral history catalog. We'll get it all to the NYPL.
It's kind of like saving like 50 years of taxes. And at a certain point, you're like, well, can I throw these away? And you're like, probably, yeah, most of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like Lainu with the metal box.
Oh my God.
Bye.
It's not that tragic.
No, it's not. I do, and I will, it's like, I also want to say that it's been heartening to see protests over around the world.
Yes.
And may the whole, and you know, the pandemic has affected the whole world. Racism affects the whole world. And may we keep moving forward to the dismantling of the patriarchy. Yeah.
Hooray.
Here's hoping. Anyhow, Leishman Mother, we thank you. Thanks for tuning in. We loves you. And our YouTube lives might be a little more TBD. And
do continue to rate, give us 5 stars. We don't like to accept anything other than 5 stars. We do like your reviews, even if they're funny and bad.
Subscribe, like, subscribe, click, link, donate, all that. Pata Bure and Authentic Movement.
And we'll be back. Watch Jess Pretty on our latest Dance and Stuff, yes, Live. It's available to you on YouTube. She's incredible. And we'll be back next week with somebody. We love you.
We loves you.